heart was pounding. What are you getting at? You might have been conceived before the wedding. Does that mean you might be my father? She said incredulously. There's more. You look exactly like my sister Natasha. Charlotte's heart seemed to rise into her throat, and she could hardly speak. You think you are my father? I'm sure of it. Oh, God! Charlotte put her face in her hands and stared into space, seeing nothing. She felt as if she were waking from a dream and could not yet figure out which aspects of the dream had been real. She thought of Papa, but he was not her Papa. She thought of Mama having a lover. She thought of Felix, her friend, and suddenly her father. She said, "Did they lie to me even about this?" She was so disoriented that she felt she would not be able to stand upright. It was as if someone had told her that all the maps she had ever seen were forgeries and she really lived in Brazil, or that the real owner of Walden Hall was Pritchard, or that horses could talk but merely kept silent by choice. But it was much worse than all those things. She said, "If you were to tell me that I am a boy, but my mother always dressed me in girl's clothing, it would be like this." She thought, "Mama and Felix." That made her blush again. Felix took her hand and stroked it. He said, "I suppose all the love and concern that a man normally gives to his wife and children went, in my case, into politics. I have to try to get all off, even if it's impossible, the way a man would have to try to save his child from drowning, even if the man could not swim." Charlotte suddenly realized how confused Felix must feel about her, the daughter he had never really had. She understood now the odd, painful way he had looked at her sometimes. "You poor man," she said. He bit his lip. "You have such a generous heart." She did not know why he should say that. "What are we going to do?" He took a deep breath. "Could you get me inside the house and hide me?" She thought for a moment. "Yes," she said. He mounted the horse behind her. The beast shook its head and snorted as if offended that it should be expected to carry a double weight. Charlotte urged it into a trot. She followed the bridle path for a while, then turned off it at an angle and headed through the wood. They went through a gate, across a paddock, and into a little lane. Felix did not yet see the house. He realized she was circling around it to approach from the north side. She was an astonishing child. She had such strength of character. Had she inherited it from him? He wanted to think so. He was very happy to have told her the truth about her birth. He had the feeling she had not quite accepted it, but she would. She had listened to him turn her world upside down, and she had reacted with emotion but without hysteria. She did not get that kind of equanimity from her mother. From the lane they turned into an orchard. Now, looking between the tops of the trees, Felix could see the roofs of Walden Hall. The orchard ended in a wall. Charlotte stopped the horse and said, "You'd better walk beside me from here. That way, if anyone should glance out of the window, they won't be able to see you very easily." Felix jumped off. They walked alongside the wall and followed it around a corner. "What's behind the wall?" Felix asked.
"Kitchen garden. Better not talk now."
"You're marvelous," Felix whispered, but she did not hear. They stopped at the next corner. Felix could see some low buildings and a yard.
"The stables," Charlotte murmured. "Stay here for a moment. When I give you the signal, follow me as fast as you can."
"Where are we going?"
"Over the roofs."
She rode into the yard, dismounted, and looped the reins over a rail. Felix watched her cross to the far side of the little yard, look both ways, then come back and look inside the stables. He heard her say, "Oh, hello, Peter." A boy of about 12 years came out, taking off his cap.
"Good morning, my lady."
Felix thought, how will she get rid of him? Charlotte said,
"Where's Daniel?"
"Having his breakfast, my lady."
"Go and fetch him, will you? And
I can do it, my lady."
"No, I want Daniel,"
Charlotte said imperiously.
"Off you go."
Marvelous, Felix thought. The boy ran off. Charlotte turned toward Felix and beckoned. He ran to her. She jumped onto a low iron bunker, then climbed onto the corrugated tin roof of a lean-to shed, and from there got onto the slate roof of a one-story stone building. Felix followed. They edged along the slate roof, moving sideways on all fours, until it ended up against a brick wall. Then they crawled up the slope to the ridge of the roof. Felix felt dreadfully conspicuous and vulnerable. Charlotte stood upright and peeped through a window in the brick wall. Felix whispered, "What's in there?" "Parlourmaid's bedroom, but they're downstairs by now, laying the breakfast table." She clambered onto the window ledge and stood upright. The bedroom was an attic room and the window was in the gable end, so that the roof peaked just above the window and sloped down either side. Charlotte moved along the sill, then cocked her leg over the edge of the roof. It looked dangerous. Felix frowned, frightened that she would fall, but she hauled herself onto the roof with ease. Felix did the same. "Now we're out of sight," Charlotte said. Felix looked around. She was right. They could not be seen from the ground. He relaxed a fraction. "There are 4 acres of roof," Charlotte told him.
4 acres? Most Russian peasants haven't got that much land."
It was quite a sight. On all sides were roofs of every material, size and pitch. Ladders and strips of decking were provided so that people could move around without treading on the slates and tiles. The guttering was as complex as the piping in the oil refinery Felix had seen at Batum. "I've never seen such a big house," he said. Charlotte stood up. "Come on, follow me." She led him up a ladder to the next roof, along a board footway, then up a short flight of wooden steps leading to a small square door set in a wall. She said, "At one time, this must have been the way they got out onto the roofs for maintenance, but now everybody has forgotten about it." She opened the door and crawled through. Gratefully, Felix followed her into the welcoming darkness. Lydia borrowed a motor car and driver from her brother-in-law, George, and having lain awake all night, left London very early. The car entered the drive at Walden Hall at 9 o'clock, and she was astonished to see, in front of the house and spreading over the park, hundreds of policemen, dozens of vehicles, and scores of dogs. George's driver threaded the car through the crowd to the south front of the house. There was an enormous tea urn on the lawn, and the policemen were queuing up with cups in their hands. Pritchard walked by carrying a mountain of sandwiches on a huge tray and looking harassed. He did not even notice that his mistress had arrived. A trestle table had been set up on the terrace, and behind it sat Stephen with Sir Arthur Langley giving instructions to half a dozen police officers who stood in front of them in a semicircle. Lydia went over to them. Sir Arthur had a map in front of him. She heard him say, "Each team will have a local man to keep you on the correct route, and a motorcyclist to dash back here and report progress every hour." Stephen looked up, saw Lydia, and left the group to speak to her. "Good morning, my dear. This is a pleasant surprise. How did you get here?"
"I borrowed George's car. What is going on?"
"Search parties."
"Oh."
With all these men looking for him, how could Felix possibly escape? Stephen said,
"Still, I wish you had stayed in town. I should have been happier for your safety."
"And I should have spent every minute wondering whether bad news was on its way." And what would count as good news, she wondered. Perhaps if Felix were simply to give up and go away. But he would not do that, she was sure. She studied her husband's face. Beneath his customary poise, there were signs of tiredness and tension. Poor Stephen, first his wife and now his daughter, deceiving him. A guilty impulse made her reach up and touch his cheek.
"Don't wear yourself out," she said.
A whistle blew. The policemen hastily drained their teacups, stuffed the remains of sandwiches into their mouths, put on their helmets, and formed themselves into 6 groups, each around a leader. Lydia stood with Stephen watching. There were a lot of shouted orders and a good deal more whistling. Finally, they began to move about. The first group went south, fanning out across the park, and entered the wood. 2 more headed west into the paddock. The other 3 groups went down the drive toward the road. Lydia regarded her lawn. It looked like the site of a Sunday school outing when all the children have gone home. Mrs. Braithwaite began to organize the clearing up with a pained expression on her face. Lydia went into the house. She met Charlotte in the hall. Charlotte was surprised to see her.
"Hello, Mama," she said. "I didn't know you were coming down."
"One gets so bored in town," Lydia said automatically. Then she thought, "What rubbish we talk."
"How did you get here?"
"I borrowed Uncle George's car." Lydia saw that Charlotte was making small talk and thinking of something else.
"You must have started very early," Charlotte said.
"Yes." Lydia wanted to say, "Stop it, let's not pretend. Why don't we speak the truth?" But she could not bring herself to do it.
"Have all those policemen gone yet?" Charlotte asked.
She was looking at Lydia in a strange way, as if seeing her for the first time. It made Lydia uncomfortable. I wish I could read my daughter's mind, she thought. She replied, Yes, they've all gone. Splendid. That was one of Stephen's words, splendid. There was, after all, something of Stephen and Charlotte. The curiosity, the determination, the poise. Since she had not inherited those things, she must have acquired them simply by imitating him. Lydia said, I hope they catch this anarchist, and watched Charlotte's reaction. I'm sure they will, Charlotte said gaily. She's very bright-eyed, Lydia thought. Why should she look that way when hundreds of policemen are combing the county for Felix? Why is she not depressed and anxious as I am? It must be that she does not expect them to catch him. For some reason she thinks he is safe. Charlotte said, Tell me something, Mama. How long does it take for a baby to grow and be born? Lydia's mouth fell open and the blood drained from her face. She stared at Charlotte, thinking, She knows, she knows. Charlotte smiled and nodded, looking faintly sad. Never mind, she said. You've answered my question. She went on down the stairs. Lydia held on to the banister, feeling faint. Felix had told Charlotte. It was just too cruel after all these years. She felt angry at Felix. Why had he ruined Charlotte's life this way? The hall spun around her head, and she heard a maid's voice say, Are you all right, my lady? Her head cleared. A little tired after the journey, she said. Take my arm. The maid took her arm, and together they walked upstairs to Lydia's room. Another maid was already unpacking Lydia's cases. There was hot water ready for her in the dressing room. Lydia sat down. Leave me now, you two, she said. Unpack later. The maids went out. Lydia unbuttoned her coat, but did not have the energy to take it off. She thought about Charlotte's mood. It had been almost vivacious, even though there was obviously a lot on her mind. Lydia understood that. She recognized it. She had sometimes felt that way. It was the mood you were in when you had spent time with Felix. You felt that life was endlessly fascinating and surprising, that there were important things to be done, that the world was full of color and passion and change. Charlotte had seen Felix, and she believed him to be safe. Lydia thought, What am I going to do? Wearily, she took off her clothes. She spent time washing and dressing again, taking the opportunity to calm herself. She wondered how Charlotte felt about Felix's being her father. She obviously liked him very much. People do, Lydia thought. People love him. Where had Charlotte got the strength to hear such news without collapsing? Lydia decided she had better take care of the housekeeping. She looked in the mirror and composed her face. Then she went out. On the way downstairs, she met a maid with a tray laden with sliced ham, scrambled eggs, fresh bread, milk, coffee, and grapes. Who is that for? She asked. For Lady Charlotte, m'lady, said the maid. Lydia passed on. Had Charlotte not even lost her appetite? She went into the morning room and sent for cook. Mrs. Rouse was a thin, nervous woman who never ate the kind of rich food she prepared for her employers. She said, I understand Mr. Thompson will be arriving for lunch, m'lady, and Mr. Churchill also for dinner. Lydia discussed the menus with her, then sent her away. Why on earth was Charlotte having such a massive breakfast in her room, she wondered, and so late? In the country, Charlotte was normally up early and had finished breakfast before Lydia surfaced. She sent for Pritchard and made the table plan with him. Pritchard told her that Alex was having all his meals in his room until further notice. It made little difference to the table plan. They still had too many men, and in the present situation Lydia could hardly invite people to make up the right numbers. She did the best she could, then sent Pritchard away. Where had Charlotte seen Felix, and why was she confident that he would not be caught? Had she found him a hiding place? Was he in some impenetrable disguise? She moved around the room, looking at the pictures, the little bronzes, the glass ornaments, the writing desk. She had a headache. She began to rearrange the flowers in a big vase by the window and knocked over the vase. She rang for someone to clear up the mess, then left the room. Her nerves were very bad. She contemplated taking some laudanum. These days it did not help her as much as it had used to. What will Charlotte do now? Will she keep the secret? Why don't children talk to one? She went along to the library with the vague idea of getting a book to take her mind off everything. When she walked in, she gave a guilty start on seeing that Stephen was there, at his desk. He looked up at her as she entered, smiled in a welcoming way, and went on writing. Lydia wandered along the bookshelves. She wondered whether to read the Bible.
There had been a great deal of Bible reading in her childhood and family prayers and much church-going. She had had stern nurses who were keen on the horrors of hell and the penalties of uncleanliness, and a Lutheran German governess who talked a great deal about sin. But since Lydia had committed fornication and brought retribution upon herself and her daughter, she had never been able to take any consolation from religion. "I should have gone into that convent," she thought, "and put myself right with God. My father's instinct was correct." She took a book at random and sat down with it open on her lap. Stephen said, "That's an unusual choice for you." He could not read the title from where he was sitting, but he knew where all the authors were placed on the shelves. He read so many books, Lydia did not know how he found the time. She looked at the spine of the book she was holding. It was Thomas Hardy's Wessex Poems. She did not like Hardy, did not like those determined, passionate women, nor the strong men whom they made helpless. They had often sat like this, she and Stephen, especially when they first came to Walden Hall. She recalled nostalgically how she would sit and read while he worked. He had been less tranquil in those days, she remembered. He used to say that nobody could make money out of agriculture any more, and that if this family were to continue to be rich and powerful, it would have to get ready for the 20th century. He had sold off some farms at that time, many thousands of acres at very low prices. Then he had put the money into railroads and banks and London property. The plan must have worked, for he soon stopped looking worried. It was after the birth of Charlotte that everything seemed to settle down. The servants adored the baby and loved Lydia for producing her. Lydia got used to English ways and was well liked by London society. There had been 18 years of tranquillity. Lydia sighed. Those years were coming to an end. For a while she had buried the secrets so successfully that they tormented nobody but her, and even she had been able to forget them at times. But now they were coming out. She had thought that London was at a safe distance from St. Petersburg, but perhaps California would have been a better choice. Or it might be that nowhere was far enough. The time of peace was over. It was all falling apart. What would happen now? This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. The Man from St. Petersburg, by Ken Follett, continued. The time of peace was over. It was all falling apart. What would happen now? She looked down at the open page and read, "She would have given a world to breathe, yes, truly, so much his life seemed hanging on her mind, and hence she lied, her heart persuaded, truly, 'twas worth her soul to be a moment kind." "Is that me?" she wondered. "Did I give my soul when I married Stephen, in order to save Felix from incarceration in the fortress of St. Peter and St. Paul? Ever since then I've been playing a part, pretending I'm not a wanton, sinful, brazen whore. But I am. And I'm not the only one. Other women feel the same. Why else would the Viscountess and Charlie Stott want adjoining bedrooms? And why would Lady Gerard tell me about them with a wink if she did not understand how they felt? If I had been just a little wanton, perhaps Stephen would have come to my bed more often, and we might have had a son." She sighed again. "Penny for 'em," Stephen said.
"What?"
"A penny for your thoughts."
Lydia smiled. "Will I never stop learning English expressions? I've never heard that one."
"Nobody ever stops learning. It means, tell me what you're thinking."
"I was thinking about Walden Hall going to George's son when you die."
"Unless we have a son." She looked at his face, the bright blue eyes, the neat grey beard. He was wearing a blue tie with white spots. He said, "Is it too late?"
"I don't know," she said, thinking. "That depends on what Charlotte does next."
"Do let's keep trying," he said.
This was an unusually frank conversation. Stephen had sensed she was in a mood to be candid. She got up from her chair and went over to stand beside him. He had a bald spot on the back of his head, she noticed. How long had that been there?
"Yes," she said, "let's keep trying."
She bent down and kissed his forehead. Then on impulse, she kissed his lips. He closed his eyes. After a moment, she broke away. He looked a little embarrassed. They rarely did this sort of thing during the day, for there were always so many servants about. She thought, why do we live the way we do if it doesn't make us happy?
she said. I do love you. He smiled. I know you do. Suddenly she could stand it no longer. She said, I must go and change for lunch before Basil Thompson arrives. He nodded. She felt his eyes following her as she left the room. She went upstairs, wondering whether there might still be a chance that she and Stephen could be happy. She went into her bedroom. She was still carrying the book of poems. She put it down. Charlotte held the key to all this. Lydia had to talk to her. One could say difficult things, after all, if one had the courage, and what now was left to lose. Without having a clear idea of what she would say, she headed for Charlotte's room on the next floor. Her footsteps made no noise on the carpet. She reached the top of the staircase and looked along the corridor. She saw Charlotte disappearing into the old nursery. She was about to call out, then stopped herself. What had Charlotte been carrying? It had looked very like a plate of sandwiches and a glass of milk. Puzzled, Lydia went along to Charlotte's bedroom. There on the table was the tray Lydia had seen the maid carrying. All the ham and all the bread had gone. Why would Charlotte order a tray of food, then make sandwiches of it, and eat it in the nursery? There was nothing in the nursery, as far as Lydia knew, except furniture covered with dust sheets. Was Charlotte so anxious that she needed to retreat into the cozy world of childhood? Lydia decided to find out. She felt uneasy about interrupting Charlotte's private ritual, whatever it was, but then she thought, it's my house, she's my daughter, and perhaps I ought to know. And it might create a moment of intimacy, and help me say what I need to say. So she left Charlotte's bedroom and went along the corridor and into the nursery. Charlotte was not there. Lydia looked around. There was the old rocking horse, his ears making twin peaks in the dust sheet. Through an open door she could see the schoolroom with maps and childish drawings on the wall. Another door led to the bedroom. That, too, was empty but for shrouds. Will all this ever be used again? Lydia wondered. Will we have nurses and diapers and tiny, tiny clothes and a nanny and toy soldiers and exercise books filled with clumsy handwriting and ink blots? But where was Charlotte? The closet door was open. Suddenly Lydia remembered. Of course, Charlotte's hideaway, the little room she thought no one else knew of, where she used to go when she had been naughty. She had furnished it herself with bits and pieces from around the house, and everyone had pretended not to know how certain things had disappeared. One of the few indulgent decisions Lydia had made was to allow Charlotte her hideaway and to forbid Maria to discover it. For Lydia herself hid away sometimes in the flower room, and she knew how important it was to have a place of your own. So Charlotte still used that little room. Lydia moved closer, more reluctant now to disturb Charlotte's privacy, but tempted all the same. No, she thought, I'll leave her be. Then she heard voices. Was Charlotte talking to herself? Lydia listened carefully. Talking to herself in Russian. Then there was another voice, a man's voice, replying in Russian in low tones, a voice like a caress, a voice which sent a sexual shudder through Lydia's body. Felix was in there. Lydia thought she would faint. Felix, within touching distance, hidden in Walden Hall, while the police searched the county for him, hidden by Charlotte. I mustn't scream. She put her fist to her mouth and bit herself. She was shaking. I must get away. I can't think straight. I don't know what to do. Her head ached horribly. I need a dose of laudanum, she thought. That prospect gave her strength. She controlled her trembling. After a moment, she tiptoed out of the nursery. She almost ran along the corridor and down the stairs to her room. The laudanum was in the dresser. She opened the bottle. She could not hold the spoon steady, so she took a gulp directly from the bottle. After a few moments, she began to feel calmer. She put the bottle and the spoon away and closed the drawer. A feeling of mild contentment began to come over her as her nerves settled down. Her head ached less. Nothing would really matter now for a while. She went to her wardrobe and opened the door. She stood staring at the rows of dresses, totally unable to make up her mind what to wear for lunch. Felix paced the tiny room like a caged tiger, three steps each way, bending his head to avoid the ceiling, listening to Charlotte. Alex's door is always locked, she said. There are two armed guards inside and one outside. The inside ones won't unlock the door unless their colleague outside tells them to. One outside and two inside. Felix scratched his head and cursed in Russian.
Difficulties, there are always difficulties, he thought. Here I am, right in the house, with an accomplice in the household, and still it isn't easy. Why shouldn't I have the luck of those boys in Sarajevo? Why did it have to turn out that I'm part of this family? He looked at Charlotte and thought, not that I regret it. She caught his look and said, what? Nothing. Whatever happens, I'm glad I found you. Me too. But what are you going to do about Alex? Could you draw a plan of the house? Charlotte made a face. I can try. You must know it. You've lived here all your life. Well, I know this part, of course, but there are bits of the house I've never been in. The butler's bedroom, the housekeeper's rooms, the cellars, the place over the kitchens where they store flour and things. Do your best. One plan for each floor. She found a piece of paper and a pencil among her childish treasures and knelt at the little table. Felix ate another sandwich and drank the rest of the milk. She had taken a long time to bring him the food because the maids had been working in her corridor. As he ate, he watched her draw, frowning and biting the end of her pencil. At one point she said, one doesn't realize how difficult this is until one tries it. She found an eraser among her old crayons and used it frequently. Felix noticed that she was able to draw perfectly straight lines without using a rule. He found the sight of her like this very touching. So she must have sat, he thought, for years in the schoolroom drawing houses, then Mama and Papa, and later the map of Europe, the leaves of the English trees, the park in winter. Walden must have seen her like this many times. Why have you changed your clothes? Felix asked. Oh, everybody has to change all the time here. Every hour of the day has its appropriate clothes, you see. You must show your shoulders at dinner time, but not at lunch. You must wear a corset for dinner, but not for tea. You can't wear an indoor gown outside. You can wear woolen stockings in the library, but not in the morning room. You can't imagine the rules I have to remember. He nodded. He was no longer capable of being surprised by the degeneracy of the ruling class. She handed him her sketches, and he became businesslike again. He studied them. Where are the guns kept? He said. She touched his arm. Don't be so abrupt, she said. I'm on your side, remember? Suddenly she was grown up again. Felix smiled ruefully. I had forgotten, he said. The guns are kept in the gun room, she pointed it out on the plan. You really did have an affair with Mama? Yes. I found it so hard to believe that she would do such a thing. She was very wild then. She still is, but she pretends otherwise. You really think she's still like that? I know it. Everything. Everything turns out to be different from how I thought it was. That's called growing up. She was pensive. What should I call you, I wonder? What do you mean? I should feel very strange calling you father. Felix will do for now. You need time to get used to the idea of me as your father. Shall I have time? Her young face was so grave that he held her hand. Why not? What will you do when you have Alex? He looked away so that she should not see the guilt in his eyes. That depends just how and when I kidnap him, but most likely I'll keep him tied up right here. You'll have to bring us food, and you'll have to send a telegram to my friends in Geneva in code, telling them what has happened. Then, when the news has achieved what we want it to achieve, we'll let Orlov go.
And then?
They will look for me in London, so I'll go north. There seem to be some big towns, Birmingham, Manchester, Hull, where I could lose myself. After a few weeks, I'll make my way back to Switzerland, then eventually to St. Petersburg. That's the place to be. That's where the revolution will start.
So I'll never see you again.
You won't want to, he thought. He said, why not? I may come back to London. You may go to St. Petersburg. We might meet in Paris. Who can tell? If there is such a thing as fate, it seems determined to bring us together. I wish I could believe this. I wish I could.
That's true,
she said with a brittle smile, and he saw that she did not believe it either. She got to her feet.
Now I must get you some water to wash in.
Don't bother. I've been a good deal dirtier than this. I don't mind.
But I do. You smell awful. I'll be back in a minute.
With that she went out. It was the dreariest luncheon Walden could remember in years. Lydia was in some kind of daze. Charlotte was silent but uncharacteristically nervy, dropping her cutlery and knocking over a glass. Thompson was taciturn. Sir Arthur Langley attempted to be convivial, but nobody responded. Walden himself was withdrawn, obsessed by the puzzle of how Felix had found out that Alex was at Walden Hall. He was tortured by the ugly suspicion that it had something to do with Lydia. After all, Lydia had told Felix that Alex was in the Savoy Hotel, and she admitted that Felix was vaguely familiar from St. Petersburg days. Could it be that Felix had some kind of hold on her? She had been behaving oddly, as if distracted all summer. And now, as he thought about Lydia in a detached way for the first time in 19 years, he admitted to himself that she was sexually lukewarm. Of course, well-bred women were supposed to be like that, but he knew perfectly well that this was a polite fiction, and that women generally suffered the same longings as men. Was it that Lydia longed for someone else, someone from her past? That would explain all sorts of things which until now had not seemed to need explanation. It was perfectly horrible, he found, to look at his lifetime companion and see a stranger. After lunch, Sir Arthur went back to the Octagon, where he had set up his headquarters. Walden and Thompson put on their hats and took their cigars out onto the terrace. The park looked lovely in the sunshine, as always. From the distant drawing-room came the crashing opening chords of the Tchaikovsky piano concerto Lydia was playing. Walden felt sad. Then the music was drowned by the roar of a motorcycle as another messenger came to report the progress of the search to Sir Arthur. So far there had been no news. A footman served coffee, then left them alone. Thompson said, "I didn't want to say this in front of Lady Walden, but I think we may have a clue to the identity of the traitor." Walden went cold. Thompson said, "Last night I interviewed Bridget Callahan, the Cork Street landlady. I'm afraid I got nothing out of her. However, I left my men to search her house. This morning they showed me what they had found." He took from his pocket an envelope, which had been torn in half, and handed the two pieces to Walden. Walden saw with a shock that the envelope bore the Walden Hall crest. Thompson said, "Do you recognize the handwriting?" Walden turned the pieces over. The envelope was addressed, "Mr. F. Chesensky, care of 19 Cork Street, London, N." Walden said, "Oh, dear God, not Charlotte." He wanted to cry. Thompson was silent. "She led him here," Walden said. "My own daughter." He stared at the envelope, willing it to disappear. The handwriting was quite unmistakable, like a juvenile version of his own script. "Look at the postmark," Thompson said. "She wrote it as soon as she arrived here. It was mailed from the village." "How could this happen?" Walden said. Thompson made no reply. "Felix was the man in the tweed cap," Walden said. "It all fits." He felt hopelessly sad, almost bereaved, as if someone dear to him had died. He looked out over his park, at trees planted 50 years ago by his father, at a lawn that had been cared for by his family for 100 years, and it all seemed worthless, worthless. He said quietly, "You fight for your country, and you're betrayed from within by socialists and revolutionists. You fight for your class, and you're betrayed by liberals. You fight for your family, and even they betray you. Charlotte. Why, Charlotte, why?" He felt a choking sensation. "What a damnable life this is, Thompson. What a damnable life." "I'll have to interview her," Thompson said. "So will I." Walden stood up. He looked at his cigar. It had gone out. He threw it away. "Let's go in." They went in. In the hall, Walden stopped a maid. "Do you know where Lady Charlotte is?"
"I believe she's in her room, my lord. Shall I go and see?"
"Yes. Tell her I wish to speak to her in her room immediately."
"Very good, my lord."
Thompson and Walden waited in the hall. Walden looked around. The marble floor, the carved staircase, the stucco ceiling, the perfect proportions, worthless. A footman drifted by silently, eyes lowered. A motorcycle messenger came in and headed for the Octagon. Pritchard crossed the hall and picked up the letters for posting from the hall table, just as he must have the day Charlotte's treacherous letter to Felix was written. The maid came down the stairs.
"Lady Charlotte is ready to see you, my lord."
Walden and Thompson went up. Charlotte's room was on the second floor at the front of the house, looking over the park. It was sunny and light, with pretty fabrics and modern furniture. "It's a long time since I've been in here," Walden thought vaguely.
"You look rather fierce, Papa," Charlotte said. "I have reason to be," Walden replied. "Mr. Thompson has just given me the most dreadful piece of news of my whole life." Charlotte frowned. Thompson said, "Lady Charlotte, where is Felix?" Charlotte turned white. "I've no idea, of course." Walden said, "Don't be so damned cool. How dare you swear at me?" "I beg your pardon," Thompson said. "Perhaps if you'd leave it to me, my lord." "Very well." Walden sat down in the window seat, thinking, "How did I find myself apologizing?" Thompson addressed Charlotte. "Lady Charlotte, I'm a policeman, and I can prove that you have committed conspiracy to murder. Now my concern, and your father's, is to let this go no further, and in particular to ensure that you will not have to go to jail for a period of many years." Walden stared at Thompson. "Jail? Surely he's merely frightening her." "But no," he realized with a sense of overwhelming dread. "He's right. She's a criminal." Thompson went on. "As long as we can prevent the murder, we feel we can cover up your participation. But if the assassin succeeds, I will have no option but to bring you to trial. And then the charge will not be conspiracy to murder, but accessory to murder. In theory, you could be hanged."
"No!"
Walden shouted involuntarily.
"Yes,"
Thompson said quietly. Walden buried his face in his hands. Thompson said, "You must save yourself that agony, and not only yourself, but your mamma and papa. You must do everything in your power to help us find Felix and save Prince Orlok."
It could not be, Walden thought desperately. He felt as if he were going insane. My daughter could not be hanged. But if Alex is killed, Charlotte will have been one of the murderers.
But it would never come to trial. Who was Home Secretary? McKenna. Walden did not know him, but Asquith would intervene to prevent a prosecution, wouldn't he? Thompson said, "Tell me when you last saw Felix." Walden watched Charlotte, waiting for her response. She stood behind a chair, gripping its back with both hands. Her knuckles showed white, but her face appeared calm. Finally she spoke. "I have nothing to tell you." Walden groaned aloud. How could she continue to be like this now that she was found out? What was going on in her mind? She seemed a stranger. He thought, when did I lose her?
"Do you know where Felix is now?"
Thompson asked her. She said nothing.
"Have you warned him of our security precautions here?"
She looked blank.
"How is he armed?"
"Nothing."
"Each time you refuse to answer a question, you become a little more guilty. Do you realize that?"
Walden noticed a change of tone in Thompson's voice and looked at him. He seemed genuinely angry now.
"Let me explain something to you," Thompson said. "You may think that your papa can save you from justice. He is perhaps thinking the same thing. But if Orlok dies, I swear to you that I will bring you to trial for murder. Now think about that."
Thompson left the room. Charlotte was dismayed to see him go. With a stranger in the room, she had just about managed to keep her composure. Alone with Papa, she was afraid she would break down. "I'll save you if I can," Papa said sadly. Charlotte swallowed thickly and looked away. "I wish he'd be angry," she thought. "I could cope with that." He looked out of the window. "I'm responsible, you see," he said painfully. "I chose your mother, I fathered you, and I brought you up. You're nothing but what I've made you. I can't understand how this has happened, I really can't." He looked back at her. "Can you explain it to me, please?" "Yes, I can," she said. She was eager to make him understand, and she was sure he would, if she could tell it right. "I don't want you to succeed in making Russia go to war, because if you do, millions of innocent Russians will be killed or wounded to no purpose." He looked surprised. "Is that it?" he said. "Is that why you've done these awful things? Is that what Felix is trying to achieve?" "Perhaps he will understand," she thought joyfully. "Yes," she said. She went on enthusiastically. "Felix also wants a revolution in Russia. Even you might think that could be a good thing, and he believes it will begin when people there find out that Alex has been trying to drag them into war."
"Do you think I want a war?" he said incredulously. "Do you think I would like it? Do you think it would do me any good?"
"Of course not. But you'd let it happen under certain circumstances.
Everyone would. Even Felix, who wants a revolution, you tell me. And if there's to be a war, we must win it. Is that an evil thing to say?
His tone was almost pleading. She was desperate for him to understand. I don't know whether it's evil, but I do know it's wrong. The Russian peasants know nothing of European politics, and they care less. But they will be shot to pieces, and have their legs blown off, and all awful things like that, because you made an agreement with Alex. She fought back tears. Papa, can't you see that's wrong?
But think of it from the British point of view, from your own personal point of view. Imagine that Freddy Chalfont and Peter and Jonathan go to war as officers, and their men are Daniel the groom and Peter the stable lad, and Jimmy the boot boy and Charles the footman and Peter Dawkins from the home farm. Wouldn't you want them to get some help? Wouldn't you be glad that the whole of the Russian nation was on their side?
Of course, especially if the Russian nation had chosen to help them. But they won't choose, will they, Papa? You and Alex will choose. You should be working to prevent war, not to win it.
If Germany attacks France, we have to help our friends, and it would be a disaster for Britain if Germany conquered Europe.
How could there be a bigger disaster than a war?
Should we never fight, then?
Only if we're invaded.
If we don't fight the Germans in France, we'll have to fight them here.
Are you sure?
It's likely.
When it happens, then we should fight.
Listen, this country hasn't been invaded for 850 years. Why? Because we've fought other people on their territory, not ours. That is why you, Lady Charlotte Walden, grew up in a peaceful and prosperous country.
How many wars were fought to prevent war? If we had not fought on other people's territory, would they have fought at all?
Who knows, he said wearily. I wish you had studied more history. I wish you and I had talked more about this sort of thing. With a son I would have, but Lord, I never dreamed my daughter would be interested in foreign policy. And now I'm paying the price for that mistake. What a price.
Charlotte, I promise you that the arithmetic of human suffering is not as straightforward as this Felix has led you to believe. Could you not believe me when I tell you that? Could you not trust me?
No, she said stubbornly. Felix wants to kill your cousin. Does that make no difference?
He's going to kidnap Alex, not kill him.
Papa shook his head. Charlotte, he's tried twice to kill Alex and once to kill me. He has killed many people in Russia. He's not a kidnapper, Charlotte. He's a murderer.
I don't believe you.
But why? He said plaintively.
Did you tell me the truth about suffragism? Did you tell me the truth about Annie? Did you tell me that in democratic Britain most people still can't vote? Did you tell me the truth about sexual intercourse?
No, I didn't.
To her horror, Charlotte saw that his cheeks were wet with tears.
It may be that everything I ever did as a father was mistaken. I didn't know the world would change the way it has. I had no idea of what a woman's role would be in the world of 1914. It begins to look as if I have been a terrible failure. But I did what I thought best for you, because I loved you, and I still do. It's not your politics that are making me cry, it's the betrayal, you see. I mean, I shall fight tooth and nail to keep you out of the courts, even if you do succeed in killing poor Alex, because you're my daughter, the most important person in the world to me. For you, I will let justice and reputation in England go to hell. I would do wrong for you without a moment's hesitation. For me, you come above all principles, all politics, everything. That's how it is in families. What hurts me so much is that you will not do the same for me. Will you?
She wanted desperately to say yes.
Will you be loyal to me, for all that I may be in the wrong, just because I am your father?
But you're not, she thought. She bowed her head. She could not look at him. They sat in silence for a minute. Then Papa blew his nose. He got up and went to the door. He took the key out of the lock and went outside. He closed the door behind him. Charlotte heard him turn the key, locking her in. She burst into tears. It was the second appalling dinner party Lydia had given in 2 days. She was the only woman at the table. Sir Arthur was glum because his vast search operation had utterly failed to turn up Felix. Charlotte and Alex were locked in their rooms. Basil Thompson and Stephen were being icily polite to each other, for Thompson had found out about Charlotte and Felix and had threatened to send Charlotte to jail. Winston Churchill was there. He had brought the treaty with him, and he and Alex had signed it, but there was no rejoicing on that account, for everyone knew that if Alex were to be assassinated, then the Tsar would refuse to ratify the deal. Churchill said that the sooner Alex was off English soil, the better. Thompson said he would devise a secure route and arrange a formidable bodyguard, and Alex could leave tomorrow. Everyone went to bed early, for there was nothing else to do. Lydia knew she would not sleep. Everything was unresolved. She had spent the afternoon in an indecisive haze, drugged with laudanum, trying to forget that Felix was there in her house. Alex would leave tomorrow, if only he could be kept safe for a few more hours. She wondered whether there might be some way she could make Felix lie low for another day. Could she go to him and tell him a lie, say that he would have his opportunity of killing Alex tomorrow night? He would never believe her. The scheme was hopeless, but once she had conceived the idea of going to see Felix, she could not get it out of her mind. She thought, out of this door, along the passage, up the stairs, along another passage, through the nursery, through the closet, and there. She closed her eyes tightly and pulled the sheet up over her head. Everything was dangerous. It was best to do nothing at all, to be motionless, paralyzed. Leave Charlotte alone, leave Felix alone, forget Alex, forget Churchill. But she did not know what was going to happen. Charlotte might go to Stephen and say, "You're not my father." Stephen might kill Felix. Felix might kill Alex. Charlotte might be accused of murder. Felix might come here to my room and kiss me. Her nerves were bad again, and she felt another headache coming on. It was a very warm night. The laudanum had worn off, but she had drunk a lot of wine at dinner, and she still felt woozy. For some reason her skin was tender tonight, and every time she moved the silk of her nightdress seemed to scrape her breasts. She was irritable both mentally and physically. She half wished Stephen would come to her, then she thought, "No, I couldn't bear it." Felix's presence in the nursery was like a bright light shining in her eyes, keeping her awake. She threw off the sheet, got up, and went to the window. She opened it wider. The breeze was hardly cooler than the air in the room. Leaning out and looking down, she could see the twin lamps burning at the portico, and the policeman walking along the front of the house, his boots crunching distantly on the gravel drive. What was Felix doing up there? Was he making a bomb, loading a gun, sharpening a knife? Or was he sleeping, content to wait for the right moment? Or wandering around the house, trying to find a way to get past Alex's bodyguards? "There's nothing I can do," she thought. "Nothing." She picked up her book. It was Hardy's Wessex Poems. "Why did I choose this?" she thought. It opened at the page she had looked at that morning. She turned up the nightlight, sat down, and read the whole poem. It was called Her Dilemma. The two were silent in a sunless church whose mildewed walls, uneven paving stones, and wasted carvings passed antique research, and nothing broke the clock's dull monotones. Leaning against a wormy poppy head, so wan and worn that he could scarcely stand, for he was soon to die, he softly said, "Tell me you love me," holding hard her hand. She would have given a world to breathe yes, truly, so much his life seemed hanging on her mind, and hence she lied, her heart persuaded thoroughly, 'twas worth her soul to be a moment kind. But the sad need thereof, his nearing death, so mocked humanity, that she shamed to prize a world conditioned thus, or care for breath where nature such dilemmas could devise. "That's right," she thought. "When life is like this, who can do right?" Her headache was so bad she thought her skull would split. She went to the drawer and took a gulp from the bottle of laudanum. Then she took another gulp. Then she went to the nursery. Chapter 15. Something had gone wrong. Felix had not seen Charlotte since midday, when she had brought him a basin, a jug of water, a towel, and a cake of soap. There must have been some kind of trouble to keep her away, Perhaps she had been forced to leave the house, or perhaps she felt she might be under observation. But she had not given him away, evidently, for here he was. Anyway, he did not need her any more. He knew where Orloff was, and he knew where the guns were. He was not able to get into Orloff's room, but the security seemed too good, so he would have to make Orloff come out. He knew how to do that. He had not used the soap and water because the little hideaway was too cramped to allow him to stand up straight and wash himself, and anyway he did not care much about cleanliness. But now he was very hot and sticky, and he wanted to feel fresh before going about his work, so he took the water out into the nursery. It felt very strange to be standing in the place where Charlotte had spent so many hours of her childhood. He put the thought out of his mind. This was no time for sentiment. He took off all his clothes and washed himself by the light of a single candle. A familiar, pleasant feeling of anticipation and excitement filled him, and he felt as if his skin were glowing. "I shall win tonight," he thought savagely, "no matter how many I have to kill." He rubbed himself all over roughly with the towel. His movements were jerky, and there was a tight sensation in the back of his throat which made him want to shout. "This must be why warriors yell war cries," he thought. He looked down at his body and saw that he had the beginnings of an erection. Then he heard Lydia say, "Why, you've grown a beard." He spun around and stared into the darkness, stupefied. He came forward into the circle of candlelight. Her blonde hair was unpinned and hung around her shoulders. She wore a long, pale nightdress with a fitted bodice and a high waist. Her arms were bare and white. She was smiling. They stood still, looking at one another. Several times she opened her mouth to speak, but no words came out. Felix felt the blood rush to his loins. "How long," he thought wildly, "how long since I stood naked before a woman?" She moved, but it did not break the spell. She stepped forward and knelt at his feet. She closed her eyes and nuzzled his body. As Felix looked down on her unseeing face, candlelight glinted off the tears on her cheeks. Lydia was 19 again, and her body was young and strong and tireless. The simple wedding was over, and she and her new husband were in the little cottage they had taken in the country. Outside, snow fell quietly in the garden. They made love by candlelight. She kissed him all over, and he said, "I have always loved you, all these years," although it was only weeks since they had met. His beard brushed her breasts, although she could not remember his growing a beard. She watched his hands busy all over her body in all the secret places, and she said, "It's you. You're doing this to me. It's you, Felix, Felix," as if there had ever been anyone else who did these things to her, who gave her this rolling, swelling pleasure. With her long fingernail she scratched his shoulder. She watched as the blood welled up, then leaned forward and licked it greedily. "You're an animal," he said. They touched one another busily all the time. They were like children let loose in a sweet shop, moving restlessly from one thing to another, touching and looking and tasting, unable to believe in their astonishing good fortune. She said, "I'm so glad we ran away together," and for some reason that made him look sad, so she said, "Stick your finger up me," and the sad look went, and desire masked his face, but she realized that she was crying, and she could not understand why. Suddenly she realized that this was a dream, and she was terrified of waking up, so she said, "Let's do it now, quickly." And they came together, and she smiled through her tears and said, "We fit." They seemed to move like dancers or courting butterflies, and she said, "This is ever so nice, dear Jesus, this is ever so nice." And then she said, "I thought this would never happen to me again," and her breath came in sobs. He buried his face in her neck, but she took his head in her hands and pushed it away so that she could see him. Now she knew that this was not a dream. She was awake. There was a taut string stretched between the back of her throat and the base of her spine, and every time it vibrated her whole body sang a single note of pleasure which got louder and louder. "Look at me," she said as she lost control, and he said gently, "I'm looking," and the note got louder. "I'm wicked," she cried as the climax hit her. "Look at me, I'm wicked." And her body convulsed, and the string got tighter and tighter, and the pleasure more piercing until she felt she was losing her mind, and then the last high note of joy broke the string, and she slumped and fainted. Felix laid her gently on the floor. Her face in the candlelight was peaceful, all the tension gone. She looked like one who had died happy. She was pale, but breathing normally. She had been half asleep, probably drugged, Felix knew, but he did not care. He felt drained and weak and helpless and grateful and very much in love. "We could start again," he thought. "She's a free woman. She could leave her husband. We could live in Switzerland. Charlotte could join us." "This is not an opium dream," he told himself. He and Lydia had made such plans before, in St. Petersburg 19 years ago, and they had been utterly impotent against the wishes of respectable people. "It doesn't happen, not in real life," he thought. "They would frustrate us all over again. They will never let me have her. But I shall have my revenge." He got to his feet and quickly put on his clothes. He picked up the candle. He looked at her once more. Her eyes were still closed. He wanted to touch her once more, to kiss her soft mouth. He hardened his heart. "Never again," he thought. He turned and went through the door. He walked softly along the carpeted corridor and down the stairs. His candle made weird moving shadows in the doorways. "I may die tonight, but not before I have killed Orloff and Walden," he thought. "I have seen my daughter, I have lain with my wife. Now I will kill my enemies, and then I can die." On the second floor landing, he stepped on a hard floor, and his boot made a loud noise. He froze and listened. He saw that there was no carpet here but a marble floor. He waited. There was no noise from the rest of the house. He took off his boots and went on in his bare feet. He had no socks. The lights were out all over the house. Would anyone be roaming around? Might someone come down to raid the larder, feeling hungry in the middle of the night? Might a butler dream he heard noises and make a tour of the house to check? Might Orloff's bodyguards need to go to the bathroom? Felix strained his hearing, ready to snuff out the candle and hide at the slightest noise. He stopped in the hall and took from his coat pocket the plans of the house Charlotte had drawn for him. He consulted the ground floor plan, briefly, holding the candle close to the paper, then turned to his right and padded along the corridor. He went through the library into the gunroom. He closed the door softly behind him and looked around. A great hideous head seemed to leap at him from the wall, and he jumped and grunted with fear. The candle went out. In the darkness he realized he had seen a tiger's head stuffed and mounted on the wall. He lit the candle again. There were trophies all around the walls, a lion, a deer, and even a rhinoceros. Walden had done some big game hunting in his time. There was also a big fish in a glass case. Felix put the candle down on the table. The guns were racked along one wall. There were 3 pairs of double-barreled shotguns, a Winchester rifle, and something that Felix thought must be an elephant gun. He had never seen an elephant gun. He had never seen an elephant. The guns were secured by a chain through their trigger guards. Felix looked along the chain. It was fastened by a large padlock to a bracket screwed into the wooden end of the rack. Felix considered what to do. He had to have a gun. He thought he might be able to snap the padlock, given a tough piece of iron such as a screwdriver to use as a lever, but it seemed to him that it might be easier to unscrew the bracket from the wood of the rack and then pass chain, padlock, and bracket through the trigger guards to free the guns. He looked again at Charlotte's plan. Next to the gun room was the flower room. He picked up his candle and went through the communicating door. He found himself in a small, cold room with a marble table and a stone sink. He heard a footstep. He doused his candle and crouched down. The sound had come from outside, from the gravel path. It had to be one of the sentries. The light of a torch flickered outside. Felix flattened himself against the door beside the window. The light grew stronger and the footsteps became louder. They stopped right outside, and the torch shone in through the window. By its light, Felix could see a rack over the sink and a few tools hanging by hooks, shears, secateurs, a small hoe and a knife. The sentry tried the door against which Felix stood. It was locked. The footsteps moved away and the light went. Felix waited a moment. What would the sentry do? Presumably he had seen the glimmer of Felix's candle, but he might think it had been the reflection of his own torch, or someone in the house might have had a perfectly legitimate reason to go into the flower room, or the sentry might be the ultra-cautious type and come and check. This book is continued on cassette number 8. The Man from St. Petersburg by Ken Follett, continued. What would the sentry do? Presumably he had seen the glimmer of Felix's candle, but he might think it had been the reflection of his own torch, or someone in the house might have had a perfectly legitimate reason to go into the flower room, or the sentry might be the ultra-cautious type and come and check. Leaving the doors open,